everybody. Welcome to the Gospel Bluth. That is the name of the podcast. That's right. This is a podcast about all things Don Bluth. Who am I? My name is Lily Mastrodimas. I do not have a background in art, graphic design, animation, film, or any of that. I just enjoy the work of Don Bluth. Today, I have a very special guest here to talk to me about the 1986 film, An American Tale. She is a filmmaker and a writer and someone who happens to have the same parents as me. Everybody, this is Ruby Mastrodimas. Say hi, Ruby.
Hey, everyone. Yeah, that is my name, Ruby Mastrodimas. It's so funny that you mentioned that.
Remind me what your middle name is,
I don't want to.
So, Ruby, what is your connection to Don Bluth films?
I mean, I didn't prepare an answer for this, but the more I thought about it, and the more, like, I prepared for, like, being, you know, rewatching this film, it occurred to me that, like, I feel like most of his dreams, I mean, most of his films are like fever dreams for me, you know? Like, we watch them repeatedly on VHS for like 5 years, just like constantly nonstop. But also, like, his actual movies and then, like, the weird sequels that they put a lot less effort and thought into.
Yeah.
Those were the ones that I think we watched more than anything else. And those are the ones that are weirdly indented in my brain. So it's that kind of thing where, like, when I watch these films, it's like, wow. Yeah, we watched these a million times, and yet some of them are just like blurs to me. And yet we consumed so many of them.
Yeah.
I don't know.
They really are like a weird staple for like our
VHS
childhood.
Home entertainment.
Yeah. For VHS home entertainment, exactly. You know, maybe you were a child in the 80s and you had this on Laserdisc. Maybe what? You were a child in the 90s and you have this on VHS. Mediums change, Ruby.
Well, I think, I mean, there's other things that when watching, specifically rewatching An American Tale, that dawned on me about this film and then other films that Don Bluthed on me. Things that Don Bluthed on me when I was watching this film. Just think about like how, because An American Tale, I mean, do we jump into it? Do we just go?
Let's jump into real quick. For folks who maybe have never seen this, which I feel like cannot be a thing. Everyone has seen this movie, but it is the tale of Fievel Moskowitz and his family who immigrate to the U.S. from Russia. And they head to New York, where during a thunderstorm, Fievel is separated from his family and then washes up in a bottle.
To
New York, where he encounters sweatshops, mob bosses,
political bosses.
I am so excited, and there's a whole thing with cats.
I mean, maybe we should just get into it, because it's such a strange movie that can you really describe the plot in a way that makes sense and is coherent?
No, I can't. So I just want to say right off the bat, I watched this on Stars, and Stars has this movie rated G for violence.
Well, okay, here's the thing. When I was, before I sat down to rewatch this movie, I had this thing in my head where, like, this vague memory of something that happened in the film that the more I thought about it, the more I was like, yeah, well, that couldn't have happened. That would have been too ridiculous for that to happen. Like, clearly I'm misremembering things. But then I sat down to actually watch it, and it turned out that, yes, in fact, the movie does open with a pogrom on a Jewish shtetl in Russia, where Cossacks come in, raise the shtetl, cat Cossacks come and raise the mouse version of the shtetl. So we're opening this this animated family film
with a traumatic experience
with genocide, with the precursor to genocide. And maybe that's because Steven Spielberg did produce this film.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but in my head, I was like, well, I think I remember them being coded as Jewish and being coded as having fled a shtetl.
They're celebrating Hanukkah.
Like, yeah, no. And then, you know, watching the film, it's straight up Hanukkah, and the Cossacks come in and burn down this Jewish village in Russia, and then they have to flee the country. So we're starting in a really dark place.
Yeah. I like, obviously that scene is terrifying for so many different reasons. It struck me that, you know, you see like the human Cossacks come.
And then the cat Cossacks.
And then the cat Cossacks. And I just had this image of like, okay, so we're led to believe that these mustachioed, uniformed cats, these mustachioed, full uniform cats have accompanied these men who saw these clothed cats.
I didn't realize there was like, a herd of cats following them.
Didn't realize there was a herd of cats like following them. Or they saw them, they're like, these guys are cool with like,
That tracks.
We're
seeing these cats like, yeah, that makes sense for us.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, for me, it was just because the other thing was I was reading the Wikipedia page for this after being horrified by the, you know, it's the kind of thing where it's like, I'm not opposed to children learning about pogroms, but I don't know if I thought did an American tale really open up conversations about anti-Semitism in the Russian Empire? I don't know. I'm reading the Wikipedia page, and apparently, so you know when they're on the ship later on after they fled Russia?
Yeah.
When Fievel falls off the boat, there's like a sea monster, like a wave beast that appears briefly.
Yeah, it's like Poseidon as a cat. Or that's what it looks like.
Apparently, Don Bluth wanted to have like a whole like sea monster sequence, and Steven Spielberg said, no, that's too dark and disturbing. But let's make sure we get the genocide in there. Let's make sure that stays in the film. But sea monsters, that may be too much for the young mind.
Jesus.
Yeah, so just interesting priorities here in this film. And starting off with a literal bang.
Oh gosh, what was I going to say? I already forgot what I was going to say.
I was talking about sea monsters. I was talking about pogroms. I was talking about Cossacks. I mean, oh, we hit a bunch of things.
That's what it was. So something that I think is like a big difference between like Disney movies, at least in the past like 40 years, and like Don Bluth movies, is that like Don Bluth, like, his movies have never, I almost said they've never strayed from telling the truth, but that's not.
Don Bluth, let's get this. Don Bluth is a straight talking sharpshooter. He says it, he tells it like it is.
He's a no nonsense animator.
The no nonsense animation king.
But like his movies, there's like such a more like realistic aspect to it. Well, no, hear me out. In like, okay, so that like the troubles that like their characters face are like, there's like an ounce of reality in there, where it's like, so American Tale, they're like obviously based on historical events like that.
Well, it's based on Steven Spielberg's grandfather.
Yeah. It's based on real history. And like Secret of Nim, like the main like danger, the main threat is like they need to like move or the family's gonna die is like the main thing. Whereas Land Before Time gets separated from his herd.
Mm.
That was a real thing that happened to dinosaurs.
Yeah, I mean, it's great that the dinosaurs, you know, it's a real thing that happened to dinosaurs, and it's good that that's getting some recognition. We're finally shining a light on what happened to dinosaurs who got separated from their herd, because I feel like that's a conversation we haven't been having as a culture and as a society.
Don't patronize me, movie. patronize. I'm tired. But my point being, like, and Disney movies are very much like overly fantastical, and there's like crazy, like there's magic there, and there's like you know, all this like conflict that seems to be based in like magic or like mythology, whereas like Don Bluth films, like the conflicts seem to be more based on like history or like realistic troubles that like kids could face.
Well, yeah, I guess the idea is like Disney is always kind of basing off of like existing fairy tales and cultural kind of storytelling tropes, and I guess that just the approach to, I guess just the approach to storytelling is very different. But it's funny to me rewatching this now and like how much went over, like what 5-year-old American child in 1980, whatever, was like, ha ha ha, I'm so glad this film is tackling Tammany Hall and the politics of political bosses. And, you know, it's something that like now I think it's fucking hilarious. Are we allowed to swear, by the way?
Oh, yes.
Wanted to check. Now I think it's fucking hilarious that there's a whole bit with Tammany Hall, but at like,
so funny.
Child, is that reading to me? Are poems reading for me? Am I coming out of that as like a 5-year-old watching this on VHS in someone's basement being like, you know, it really was horrific the way that the Tsar, you know, treated the Jewish population of the Russian Empire. Like, am I coming out of it thinking, no.
Well, I mean, you specifically as a young child, you were very in tune with with the facts, with history. And you were like, yeah,
I was sitting there watching this film fact checking as a child.
Yeah, you had your textbooks open and you were like, okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. Whereas I was just stoked to see mice. Yeah. Meanwhile, I was just like, mice in suits.
Yeah, well, when they start, as soon as they start singing, like, there's no cats in America and the streets are paved with cheese, I'm like, actually?
Actually, bitch?
The streets are paved with stone, and there's a lot of cats, and I don't like any of them.
Bitch, there's a lot of cats on these streets, okay?
Can we talk about that number, though? There's no cats in America and the streets are paved with cheese.
I mean, we have to, because it's... I'm going to say something very controversial. It is like maybe this one of two good songs in the entire soundtrack. I mean, obviously Somewhere Out There is the best song on the soundtrack. We don't have to talk about this now because
that's going to have to have a whole portion.
It's going
to
have a whole thing.
It's going to be a whole hour.
strap in, people. But No Cats in America is like a close second. And all the other songs are bad.
I will say this about all the other songs, and actually this about Don Bluth movies. There's very few songs, which is great.
I love
They stick to the plot. That. They stick to the action. He sticks with the narrative. So like the songs, it's like they come in every now and then, but really it's like, it's very spare how many songs. Whereas opposed to, you know, that's where I'll give... As opposed to Disney, it's like, song, 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 what's going to be a hit? And not many of them are. Some of them, not many.
Yeah, Don Bluth left Disney because he didn't like their style of, like, writing these movies and, like, doing the animation. He wanted to, like, make animated films that focused more on the story.
And he should say it.
Exactly, which is why most of his films are just absolute bangers.
The film is the banger, even if the soundtrack is, you know, spare on bangers.
Exactly. But let's talk No Cats, There Are No Cats in America, which opens much like the first number in Fiddler on a Roof. just Papa going back home in Mother Russia, and then I immediately got a flashback to, but in our little village of Anatevka.
Well, yeah, he's clearly Tevye, right? I mean, Papa is meant to be Tevye.
And I love him for it.
He's a fiddler. That's what he does. He plays the violin. We never see him on a roof, but there's no... Actually, wait a second. At what point he's on a landing?
That could count.
Yeah, we'll talk. Okay, we can get into that later because I still have thoughts about this song. About whether or not Pop is a fiddler on a roof, because that's its own thing. But, you know, this song is a banger. So obviously all the immigrants are, you know, all the nice immigrants are on the ship and they're going over to New York and talking about how great it's going to be, but also like where they come from and the stuff that's going on there. And we get two. So in addition to like, you know, the narrative of what just happened in the race shuttle, we get two other immigrant narratives. Willie, do you want to talk about what they are? Because I had to stop and be like, what?
I had forgotten like about these two narratives, and when they happened, I also had to stop and just like furiously take down notes about everything I was feeling and thinking.
Yeah, because there's Sicily Mouse.
There's the Sicily Mouse and there's the Irish Mouse. And Sicily Mouse is built like a strong man. Sicily Mouse has big puffy muscular chest, teeny tiny legs. He's jacked. He's absolutely jacked.
He's jacked, but he's been skipping leg day. Let's say it. Let's call it what it is.
Guys, we gotta be honest here.
Let's be honest. He's been skipping leg day, Sicilian Mouse.
Sicily Mouse is skipping leg day and lifting pure steel. And in Sicily, there's a no provolone is something that is supposed to just, you know, make us hurt for him.
Yeah, and we totally know what that means, again, as five-year-olds with extensive knowledge of cheese.
No provolone. No provolone. That is so funny.
And you really sounded like you meant it when you said, that's so funny.
Ruby, I did.
That's really funny. I have to laugh at that. That's really funny.
I just like crack myself up sometimes.
Sicilian Mouse, no provolone.
No provolone. His mama mia goes to speak to the mob boss, the Don, I think it was like it's Don Tablieri.
You're right. It was he's a cat though, which is significant.
He's a tabby cat. Yes, obviously he's a cat because all cats are villains and all mice are good. And rats are in between.
Moral gray area.
Yeah, exactly. Rats take the moral gray area. Mamma Mia goes to speak to the Don Tablieri, Tablioni, whatever, it's a play on Tabby, and to ask him to pay
for something.
His brother was like eaten by one of the cats. And then the mob boss was like, well, come in and like, I'll see what I can do to like repay you.
And what happens?
Mamma Mia is eaten by the Don.
Don eats Mamma Mia.
So this is
why this man is leaving.
This Sicily Mouse lost his entire family. His entire family. To the mob. Sopranos, but it's mice.
Sopranos, but it's the mice that live in Tony's basement.
Oh,
and it's just they pull the same trick as an American Tale, where it's like the human world and then the mice world that like replicates it directly underneath. Yeah. So the Sopranos, but it's mice, and the feds are cats.
The feds are cats.
Okay, but the Irish Mouse, because this is what got me.
Okay, yeah. Okay? Why don't you talk about the Irish Mouse?
So then the Irish Mouse, he comes in and he starts singing like his jaunty little like Tooray Looray, you know, like the stereotypical ballad about his bonnie lass, which, yeah, he calls her his bonnie lass, right? Which is Scottish, whatever.
And her name Nan.
I think she died of consumption, which, I don't know. No. The point is she dies. She dies mysteriously and then he decides to leave because he's Irish and sad. And here's my issue. If we're opening this film with a pogrom, why can we not talk about the Irish famine, like the Great Potato Famine,
Ruby,
on this ship?
This movie takes place in 1885.
I know that the timelines don't match up, but I just feel like it needed to be addressed because this is an American Tale posits itself. It positions itself as the preeminent discussion on 19th century immigration into New York. That's what this film is about. At its core, it's talking about the experience of all people who came through Ellis Island, who came to New York for a better life. And they couldn't talk about the famine. They didn't. Steven Spielberg didn't have the guts.
Ruby, to are talk you about the famine. Are you saying that this is Irish American erasure?
I am exactly. I'm. Yeah.
This is Irish American discrimination.
I would say it's. Yeah, it's deeply discriminatory.
Mm.
Shameful. I almost called the Pope when I saw this. I don't have his number, but I thought about calling him.
Just go, hey Pope. You pray.
Hey, Papa.
Hey, Papa. Hey, Mr. Papa. I have something to say. Well, okay. So, actually, and I hate to point and say actually.
She's pointing at me.
And saying actually. I'm so sorry. The Bonnie Lass was eaten by a cat. And all that was left was her tail.
Oh, you know, I missed that. Because his accent was not particularly well done, and I was just too kind of like stunned as to like what the fuck is going on here on this day with this Touraloo-Raye thing.
I know. It made me mad because he said it was a calico cat, and then referred to the calico cat as he, which is not accurate because the coloration of calico cats always indicates that they are female.
That's nerd level shit.
I know.
Is that common knowledge? Is that something that people know or just you?
Excuse me, it's something that people should know.
Oh, right.
But also, okay. I think more people know it now than they did then.
than they did back in the 80s when Dom was in, people are more educated now, so people know not to make those mistakes about.
It's been
about cats,
but that's what made them. That's what made me mad. But okay, yeah, I know. I pick and choose my battles. Really.
I just wanted more famine talk. I thought we deserved more talk about. So I think, you know, because the film was positing itself as more political. So even if it's not the famine, let's talk about why the Irish are leaving and why the Irish mice are leaving. Why thousands are sailing across the Western Ocean. You know.
A land of opportunity?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm blanking on the next lyric. That some of them may never see.
Some may never see. And we dance. Yeah, and they do dance.
Ireland.
You know, No Cats in America is an absolutely unhinged song. Like, just...
I wish it went on longer. I wish it went down and ticked every single immigrant experience and then burst into the row of there are no cats in America and the streets are paved with cheese.
Well, think about the transitions in this song. It's all these like really traumatic, deeply upsetting like ballads that these mice are saying. Are singing, like, you know, cats ate my family, cats ate my one true love, and like these really like heart-wrenching tales to everybody holding hands and screaming that there are no cats in America. Like these verses transition into the chorus by someone going, but.
Yeah, it's that person being like, get over it, because.
It's just like,
yeah,
it's crazy to me. This song is
Yeah, your unreal. Mom got eaten. But I mean, you know, I don't know. Personally, as someone who never, my mother is, thankfully, she's not been eaten by cats yet, but you know, we'll see. She and the dog are getting along really well, so I feel like maybe it could be one of those things.
Who's your mother?
Do we have a different one?
I don't know, Ruby. You tell me. This could be news.
My mother. Well, you know, I'm thinking about the listeners back home who are probably just our mother. if we're being completely honest.
Let's be completely honest.
The target audience is our mother. Hi, Mom.
Hi, Mom.
But thinking about, you know, like, my mother has never been eaten by cats. You know, fingers crossed it stays that way. But I don't know, you know, I guess it's that feeling of like, you know, you're leaving it all behind to move on, you know, separating from the old life and moving into the new world where, yeah.
You know what I would have loved to
hear? Do I even need to say it? Have you heard the good news? There are no cats in America, no mom-eating cats in America, and on top of that, the streets are paved with cheese.
You know what I would have loved to hear? I would have loved to hear the mouse who is going over to America just for, like, better employment opportunities. Like, no tragedy, no nothing. It's just like...
I want the one who was on the run because he did something shitty in his old country.
I stole a car. No cars in 1885.
I would be like, for some reason, I want the, like, the Madame Zeroni, you know, like the whole thing where it's like, I didn't carry Madame Zeroni up the mountain and now my family is cursed and that's why I'm coming to America. I need more shit like that. Like, it's the losers.
Yeah, I want the losers.
Like, our people, let's be honest, people coming over.
Mm-hmm.
Our ancestors.
Greeks.
The losers.
Yeah. I just want the mouse who was like, the bank at home would not give me a loan, so I'm leaving.
How about this? I don't know. I just thought it would be nice, like, a change of scenery.
Yeah. As easy as that. Does everything have to boil down to cats are fucking monsters and they destroy families?
Well, I personally am okay with that because, you know, I don't like cats, so yeah, I feel like that stands for me. I mean... This happens before Fievel falls off the ship, right?
Yes.
So Fievel's party to this. So can I talk about, I think, why this, like, something that struck me as I was watching this movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the whole plot of this movie is that Fievel gets separated from his family, and they think he's dead, and he has to find his way back to them, which was such, like, a big plot in, I don't know, when I was a kid, I realized my deepest fear is that I would end up in a situation like that where, like, I got separated and had to have some kind of weird, like, brave little toaster-like journey back home. Which, by the way, that movie is particularly traumatic.
That movie,
I don't want to go into that.
It's so fucking scary. We don't need to talk about it, though.
Like, there's certain times where I still, like, I can't throw away this inanimate object. And it's because of that, like, sad, heated blanket in the brave little toaster who was, like, a baby.
Yeah.
It's because of that heated blanket that I sometimes have a really hard time, like, just being like, yeah, this thing is broken. I should throw it out. I shouldn't be attached to inanimate objects, but thanks, Brave Little Toaster.
Brave Little Toaster, but anyway, encourages hoarding, but yeah.
Do kids nowadays, like, have that kind of anxiety? You know, because I hate to be the grandma, but, you know, kids these days with their phones. Like, you know, if a kid gets lost.
Oh, a hot take.
If a kid gets lost, you know, like, he shows up, he goes to a shop, and then all of a sudden, like, someone, like, takes a picture of him and like, you know, adds the mom and geotags the location, and there, that's, like, problem solved. Now it's, but, like, back when we were kids, if you were lost, I just assumed, like, we were gone forever, you know?
I feel like, I don't think I knew this about you. That this was your greatest fear as a little kid.
Well, because when you watch these films, it's always like, oh my god, how are they going to find your way? You know, it's that thing where you're on the subway, mm-hmm. and you're on the subway with someone, and what if they accidentally get off a stop too early? Do you get off at the next stop and wait for them, or do you get back on? Like, you're just going to constantly miss each other. And that, but, like, when I was, nowadays, you know, we've got technology. I can, again, like, geotag a location, someone can find me. But when we were kids, I was like, what would I do in that situation? It was like, guess I'll just ride the rails and figure out, like, become friends with, like, pigeons and they'll help me find my way home, you know? Like, I couldn't have what I would do.
I was just ready to become friends with pigeons wherever I go.
Yeah, and I'm not thrilled about that for you. Like, for me, it was like extenuating circumstances would lead me to become like friends with pigeons and feral animals. For you, you're just ready right off the bat. You could be having a good day and you're like, guess what? The squirrel's my friend now. And I worry, for that reason, I worry about you sometimes.
I'm doing great. I'm here. Well, okay. So let's talk about Fievel's actual separation. Because rewatching this, I didn't realize how much of a little shit he is.
No, he's not. He's just a baby.
Look, I understand. He is literally a baby. I have this written several times in my notes. Fievel is a baby.
He is a baby.
He is a very cute baby. But at the same time, he's a little shit. And I'll tell you why.
No, he's because not. I can't abide by this.
Because he sees the storm happening. And he sees that this fish is, like, being thrown down. He gets very excited about it. And I would be too, if I was like his age and like there was a big storm and a fish came barreling through the door, I'd want to go check it out as well. But he decides to just throw his hat. He's going to make it complicated. He's going to throw his hat up onto the deck and then he's going to tell his dad, I'm just getting my hat. And not just like, I want to see the fish. Because his dad was like, had been telling him before about all the fish and that, like, maybe they could go see the fish.
So it's his dad's fault. Let's be clear about that. Because his dad introduced him to the concept of fish, and now his dad has to suffer the consequences of giving his son that knowledge. Okay?
No, it's Fievel's fault. Fievel fucking threw his hat and was like,
Fievel is a child. Fievel is a child.
Again, several times, Fievel is a baby. I have it written several times.
But I can't abide by this. He just wanted to have a little bit. How was he supposed to know he was going to drown? The kid was clearly never on a boat before. He grew up in a landlocked shtetl, Lily.
He's a little shit, and I love him. And I say that in an endearing way.
It is not his fault he got swept off a boat because he wanted to, like, you know, look at fish. And the fact that you're blaming him for this, I'm... Frankly, I'm really upset by it.
Your face is turning red, and I'm beginning to wonder if I have offended you.
No, you know, to be honest, it's just things are reflecting onto my face. It's just the way that light works. Oh, I changed the lighting, I would be alabaster.
Look at that.
If I changed the lighting, I'd be alabaster.
Please stop. Please stop saying that.
Yeah, well, I mean, to the point of for those of you at home, mom, the only mom. Person listening to this, who may or may not remember or have seen this movie, the other great thing about this movie that I do love is that Fievel is actually voiced by a child.
Yeah.
Like, the voice actor for Fievel is a little baby kid.
That kid which just makes turned everything 42.
Just so much more like, well, okay, maybe he's 42 now, but he wasn't. He was a big little baby then.
I'm just saying that because, like, happy birthday.
Oh, happy birthday, yeah. Fievel. But it makes everything so much cuter. Like, it's not just like, am I listening to a 45-year-old woman pretending to be an 8-year-old boy? No. It's a little, so when he cries, because sometimes Fievel cries because he gets sad, I'm like, oh, that's a baby. Oh, that's a baby. He needs a hug.
No, and I really did appreciate that about the way that they cast Fievel. Because, like, it does make it that much more realistic. I mean, yes, he is...
Heartrending. It's not even just realistic. I'm like, oh, fuck, they are emotionally manipulating me up the wazoo with the sound of this literal crying child.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'm just old now that works on me.
Yeah. Oh, stop this child from crying. Oh,
this poor child. Oh. This is mother.
I know, it, like, they really do such a good job with it. And I love Fievel. I think he's very cute. I think he's got a lot of sass. And sometimes I think he's a little shit. I think all of these things can be true.
Yeah, but I just, again, I want to make it very, very clear to everyone. It is not your fault unless you willingly go on like a cruise ship, which is a different issue, but it is not your fault if you ever get swept overboard. But if you ever go on a cruise ship, whatever happens to you is your fault. And also there is no liability because of the way that jurisdiction works on the seas. So that's, again, that's on you, but that's not the case for him because his family is immigrating. But if you ever go on a cruise ship and your body disappears overboard, it's going to be tremendously hard for your body, not only to be recovered, but also who gets to investigate it? The jurisdictions are really messy, so you'll just never get that closure. And that's on you because you chose to go on a cruise.
Ruby, I want to just say thank you so much for saying that.
I feel like people needed to hear.
I think it's really important for our listeners to know. You know, the Gospel Bluth, we're not just talking about the movies. We're talking about the facts.
I can't believe you named this that. She didn't tell me what the name of this podcast was. So she pops on, she's like, welcome to the Gospel Bluth. Oh my God, I should have logged out right then and there when you said that.
Ruby, you've known me for 24 years and
almost 25.
And you should know I am a monster.
You are a monster. And yeah. For mom listening at home, for our listener at home, mom, how could you do this? How could you let her become this?
Yay!
I'm sorry.
No,
I'm being cruel.
Ruby, no. You're just being you.
Well, I mean, it's all okay because we let's be honest, we all know that this talk is going to end with the two of us serenading each other with Somewhere Out There. So that means that all the tension that, you know, we're going to build until we get to that point will be, you know, we'll be washed away of those sins as soon as we, you know, move into a stirring duet.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah.
So something to look forward to for the listeners at home, mom.
So I would like to move to Fievel's arrival.
Fievel's arrival.
That's fine. So we see him, he's in this bottle and he's floating in the waters of the Hudson. Ooh. And we hear a choir singing and it sounds like, you know, it's supposed to be this like stirring choir of angels, or like something that's, you know, you're supposed to feel like hopeful and wonder and awe. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that it is, the choir is singing the actual Statue of Liberty poem by, who was it, Emma Lazarus? Is that it?
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Emma Lazarus, yeah.
Yeah. They are singing the fucking
Lady. You're tired,
lady
you're poor, you're huddled masses yearning to be free. I didn't catch that when it was happening. I can break into that at any moment.
Oh, it's the way that the chorus sings it is terrifying. It makes it just like it feels like a nightmare that's happening.
Funny, this one in one ear and out the other for me.
So I just also want to bring up a what feels like a classic trope to me. Because Don Bluth seems to have a thing with French birds.
I don't want to talk about that French. I have things to say about that French bird, but I don't want to talk about it.
Did you know Christopher Plummer plays on
Lee? That was my issue, because I was watching that scene, and I was like, I fucking hate this bird. I hate his accent. I hate what he's saying. I hate what he's doing. I hate this French pigeon. I hate him. I hate his song. And then to break my heart, because who do I love?
I love Christopher Plummer.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I was so upset when I found out that was him. I almost felt like I had to I don't have his email, but I felt like I should email him.
I just simply had to email Christopher Plummer.
I'll shoot an email to like christopherplummer@gmail.net and see if someone responds. If I don't get the mailer, Damon, I'm going to assume it's him. I hated that bird.
I hate that bird. I hate that song. I hate that bird hangs out with like those like
pigeons
other French, yeah, those like big boob, big tit birds. Those big tit pigeons. No. Because also, Don Bluth has a thing with French birds, because we have Henri the pigeon, who is French in this movie. A Christopher Plummer. Yes. Who helps Fievel get, like, find his footing. We also have the French bird in Anastasia. Not Anastasia. Sorry, Thumbelina.
Anastasia?
Anastasia. No, the French bird in Thumbelina. The swallow. So they are always French birds, and they are always staunchly against things, or staunchly for things. So Henri is all about never saying never.
Never say never again.
I also just have a note that says, never say never. No!
Justin Bieber.
That's right.
If I did take notes, which I didn't really, if I did take notes, it would just say never, Justin Bieber, ha ha. And that would be the kind of note that I write to myself and then don't mention.
That's a good note. But I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good note.
That's a for Ruby note. Just for Ruby.
Just for Ruby. Notes. Just for Ruby. But yeah. Aldly with Never Say Never, and then the French bird and Thumbelina thing, Follow Your Heart. Both things just lead to disaster for the characters they are singing to. So I think all French birds in Don Bluth films are the cause of all the problems that their characters encounter, that their protagonists encounter.
No, the cause... Fievel's problems are like anti-Semitism and the fact that he got, you know, thrown overboard.
Yes, no. That's a big
thing. That's not Henri's fault.
No, absolutely. But like, Henri, like bringing, like having his.
I love,
like,
by the way, that you're insistent on saying it with the proper accent, which I just refuse. I refuse because I don't respect that pigeon.
I just want people to know that I'm cultured.
See,
I say while hosting a podcast about Don Bluth.
The Gospel Bluth. I fucking hate that title.
It's too late now. We've said it too many times in these episodes. I have to run with it, unfortunately.
You could just, like, do some ADR and just dub it over. So every time someone says the Gospel Bluth, you, like, buzz it out. And then it's someone's clearly... recorded voice later going like the Don Bluth podcast with Lily Mastrodemus after over every time.
I hate that so much.
It's an option. Just something to think about.
I don't
Is Squarespace sponsoring this? Do you have any sponsors? Do you have any corporate sponsors?
No sponsors. Yeah, no, obviously Fievel's, like, the bulk of Fievel's issues come from anti-Semitism and falling off of a boat. But I think once he gets to America, it's all Henry's fault. Because Henry's never say never attitude steers Fievel into the hands of Warranty Rat, which then, like, causes him to just miss his fucking, like, he walks past his family so many times.
And that's where my anxiety comes in. Again, because I know when I get separated from my family on our big move, you know, I'm the electric blanket in the brave little toaster. And there's so many moments where I could have been reunited with my family. And instead, I spend the night in a tree at one point. Do you remember that scene in the brave little toaster?
Yes, it was terrifying.
I hated it.
Ruby, I understand your anxiety of being separated from your family. How does it feel right now to be living in London while the rest of your family lives in New York, New Jersey?
Well, I didn't, like, slip and fall onto a plane, which is the difference. I didn't, like, it'd be one thing if I slip, you know, all of a sudden I'm, like, you know, walking down the street and some man points and I, like, get a little spun around and all of a sudden I, like, fall onto a plane and it, like, flies across the ocean. That would be very different.
So, I want to talk about Warranty Rat just very quickly, because I know there's so much more that we need to talk about. But I love Warranty Rat. I love how sleazy he is. I love his voice. I think...
Oh, he has such a good voice.
He's such a good... That's what I love about Don Bluth villains. They always have...
He gets the voices.
He gets great voices for them, and, like, they always have great, like, personality. He has a great personality. But they always have these, like, really interesting characters. They just always seem to have... They're not, like, evil for the sake of being evil. They just have, like, these... You know, they have their own agenda, which I really... appreciate as somebody who is trying to have her own agenda.
So you take inspiration from these men?
I take inspiration from these absolute villains. That's right.
I did watch today an American Tale, Five Goes West.
Good.
Which the whole, I mean, I don't know if we were going to talk about that, but I mean, the villain in that is just John Cleese trying to exploit people's labor to build up a town, and then he's going to eat them after they've done all the work for him. And he's British.
Of course he is. I'll say it.
Whereas Warren T. Rat, he's a good old-fashioned American scammer.
I mean... speaking of fun great characters, let's talk about Tony
Topony,
our absolute king.
I mean, you know, he's a little street, he's like the Artful Dodger, but like without the villainy that the Artful Dodger later gets from Fagin. Not to go right into too much into Oliver, whatever. Anyway, point being, I love Tony. He's great.
I love Tony. I think he is wonderful. Again, love the voice. Classic.
I thought he had a bigger role in this movie because, again, I mentioned at, like, the head of this podcast that I mostly associate all of these movies with their, like, direct-to-DVD or just TV-only sequels.
Yeah.
And he had a really prominent role in the one where they found that underground Native American tribe, right?
Yeah.
He was really prominent in that one. So I remember him more from that than I do from this.
Like, all the sequels, he is, like, the supporting character.
He has only a brief cameo in An American Tale, Five Goes West, where he's married to Bridget.
Of course.
They move west and have a baby.
That whole thing, I'm sorry, he and Bridget just, like, meet, and 5 minutes later, they are fucking boning in a hat in love.
Yeah.
Like,
why must you be so crass about it, Lily? Why you gotta be so crass?
Ruby,
bone in a hat.
Okay, after the cats attack and they like fall through the hat, like there's like a moment where you hear like chuckling in the little hat. And indicative of bonking.
Pilgrim, they could have just been heavy petting.
Which
you know, Puritan children used to do that. Puritan teens, they were allowed to do heavy petting. That was legal in the Puritan colonies. So
is this,
you know,
true?
It actually was.
Oh, that's really funny.
I still don't really know if I know what heavy petting is, but I know it was. What, you know, it's not a sin. It's not a sin yet.
Well, then
it's
let me ask
before the sin.
Let me ask this then: do you think within the confines of the hat? Tony and Bridget made it to first base, second base?
I am not engaging with this question. These are cartoon mice. You know what happens? This is how you're going to get suddenly a following of, like, just furries.
Hey,
okay, Lily?
Don't shame the furries.
I'm not shaming furries, but if I don't engage with that, I support their choice to be furries, but I will not contribute to furry culture in that way. I'm not going to participate in the creation of furry fodder. Okay. And you're trying to trap me into that. And I see your trap and I'm swerving out of the way.
Ruby, who do you think is the hottest mouse? In this?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Oh no. Okay. That's fine. I'm just a big
penning in that hat, and that's all we need to know. And we don't even, you know what? You can pet an animal. That's a thing that people do. So, you know, maybe it wasn't even sexual what was going on in that hat. Maybe he told a really good joke and he was doing some shadow puppets. Tony was doing shadow puppets in the hat, and Bridget said, That's very funny. Because she's Irish or something.
She's an Irish activist mouse.
Give her her due.
Look, I respect the hell out of her.
She's more than just she's more than just a girl who fell into a hat with Tony, and that's all you care about. And I think that's the issue here.
Excuse me,
you are reducing her.
Excuse me, absolutely not. I think she has a lot of strength and a lot of good points. I love that she is.
Would you say she's a strong female character?
I would say I enjoy Bridget. I think she has a lot of good stuff, a lot of good ideas. I did not like her laugh. I don't like here's what I will say. I don't like the features and like the characteristics that like the animators and the writers like give to like female characters, like that kind of like laugh for like
I hate it. I think the voice acting was bad.
The voice acting is awful. Awful. No, absolutely.
And like that bad like plastic patty Irish accent thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
Oof.
Yeah.
Rough.
No, it's 100% bad. The only good voice actors were Fievel, Madeline Kahn.
No, there were multiple good voice actors. Because yeah, Madeline Kahn is in this, which we haven't even talked about. We haven't even scratched the surface.
I love her. Dom DeLuise, just, I love him so much.
We haven't even scratched the surface of Dom DeLuise. We haven't even touched on Dom DeLuise at all. I wasn't actually taking notes, but if I was taking notes, one of them would just be in big letters. Needed more Dom DeLuise.
Yeah.
Not enough Dom DeLuise.
So then let's get into where we meet our other favorite voice actors then. So Madeline Kahn we meet at Tammany Hall with Honest John. There is an Irish wake happening. There's a dead mouse on the table. I love that there is a Tammany Hall mouse.
I think that was so... I paused when it happened because I just needed a moment to collect myself because I fucking love Tammany. I love Tammany Hall.
I think they had some really good ideas. Yeah, I do love Honest John. I did, as an Irish American, I did think it was a little discriminatory that they just have him drunk on whiskey the entire time that he is on screen.
Yeah, why couldn't he have been drunk on rye?
Yeah. Why couldn't he have been enjoying a nice glass of Pinot Noir?
Yeah, like a fine wine.
Yeah.
Why did it have to be whiskey that he was drunk on?
And it simply had to be whiskey, didn't it?
Interesting, Don.
I just find that really interesting, Don.
I think it's interesting, Don Bluth. We'll have a chat. Donald.
Get in touch.
Is Don Bluth still alive?
Yeah, he is. Ruby, did you know that Don Bluth was a Disney animator for Robin Hood?
Don't say Robin Hood.
I said Robin Hood. It was Robin Hood. Did you know that? Because really now you do.
I. Oh my god!
I love bringing that up because it seems like the one.
Everybody knows. Everybody knows.
The one movie.
I'm not going to say it. Don't say it. Don't say it because I think everyone knows what we mean when we say Robin Hood.
Yeah, everybody knows it. Everybody agrees. And knowing that Don Bluth was attached to that movie suddenly makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, but again, I refuse to sexualize the mice and rats in An American Tale.
Well, you simply hate rodents, but you love foxes.
But I love Fievel.
That's true. Fievel, who is a baby. Let's talk about Gussie's absolute dump truck ass.
No! What is wrong with you?
Ruby, I don't know. We don't have to talk. I wrote it as a joke.
Well, you got me.
Gussie, as played by Madeline Kahn, a brilliant voice work there.
When did she pass away? I'm sorry, every time a name gets mentioned, I'm like, are they dead? Are they dying?
Hey Siri, when did Madeline Kahn die?
Madeleine Kahn died the 3rd of December, 1999, at age 57 in New York City.
It's tragic.
So it was much after the fact, but yeah, because I love her. And it was, I mean, it was such a clear homage to her role in Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
With the same, like, Willie? Like, Willie Labbitt's, the weird, like, Marlena Dietrich voice. Mm. Oh, God.
Oh, what a wowie. Legend.
Oh, wowie. Oh, what? Oh, wowie. Oh, a rally.
A gathering.
A gathering. I love her. Maybe, but perhaps I would go as far to say that she might have been underutilized.
Oh, absolutely.
I feel like every person in this movie, I'm like, they were underutilized. I think what I really wanted was an American Tale, like, 6-part miniseries.
Yeah. Well, there was a short-lived TV series. I mean, short-lived, it was not very good. But I think this
we definitely watched it.
Yeah, we probably did. But this was after Don Bluth, the partnership between Don Bluth and Steven Spielberg ceased to be. And Steven Spielberg had the rights to An American Tale.
Is that why we're not allowed to talk about An American Tale, Five Will Goes West? Because that technically wasn't Don Bluth. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm going off the rails. I also have the train stuff in that movie.
Ruby, get back on the rails because it's time to talk about Somewhere Out There.
Somewhere out there, beneath the pale moonlight.
Wait, stop singing. Stop, because now I'm not sure if I have to pay somebody for that.
Just redact it. Just redact it. Just edit out to a whole, like, oh, you know what you should do? You should, like, warp our voices so we sound like,
Mice.
We're like anonymous in one of those TV shows about like paranormal activity, but we don't want to admit that we thought our house was haunted. So it's
yes.
Ugh. No, you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
Mom, the listener at home, do you know what we're talking about?
So
listeners at home, mom and dad.
Somewhere Out There is absolutely faultless. I love when his voice cracks. When he hits the high notes, I think that
it's adorable.
So sweet, so cute. Yeah, it's the perfect song, and it's an award-winning song, nominated and won for Song of the Year and Best Song Written Specifically for a Motion Picture or Television at the Grammy Awards. It was also nominated for an Academy Award for Best Music Original Song.
It deserved it.
It absolutely did.
I mean,
yeah.
Do you remember the Time Life Collections compilation disc commercials that they would do for, like, you know, hits of the 80s, hits of this, and they had one, like, Timeless Love Ballads?
Yeah.
It's the one where they have, like, the Michael Bolton thing where it's like, tell me how am I supposed to live without you? You know that one?
Mm-hmm.
You know this this is in there for a split second, and it's, you know, with Linda Ronstadt singing it. And so, yeah, I mean, that just tells you how iconic it is that it was on the Timeless Love Songs compilation album with Michael Bolton. And Boys to Men, and I mean, I hope that no one made love to this song. Now that I think about it,
I hope they did.
It's not a song about romantic love.
No, it's about two siblings who. miss each other
divided.
Deeply. Divided,
yeah.
Lost.
After one falls off a ship. Yeah.
I can't. Oh, believe and that's also that.
I know. Can you believe it? Wild, right? That's the commercial that begins with Cher going like, cause I'm your lady. I can't hit any of these notes. What a key.
Oh, yeah. Cause I'm your
and
lady.
You are my man. Yeah, that's my range.
It's a good range.
It's not. It's a really limited one.
Ruby, I think
I can only do Bruce Springsteen at karaoke.
I think your range is great. Somewhere Out There is a perfect song. Everything about it is great. The lyrics are amazing. The melody is beautiful.
It is really sweet the way that they do it in the film. That, like, again, the fact that they in the film itself, they don't try to like beautify it and have all these beautiful, you know, like switch to singers where you're like, that's not them. That small child is not Linda Ronstadt, you know.
Yeah.
They let the children sing it. So again, because it's clearly the voice of like an 8-year-old boy and maybe a 12-year-old girl, it becomes quite, it really is quite touching. So I'm sitting there watching it. And yeah, I'll say it. I teared up. I'll be honest about it.
There's no shame here. This is a safe space.
There's a lot of shame.
Ruby, shut up. There's Ruby. There.
That's
shut
for
up.
Different reasons.
Ruby, shut up. There's no shame here. Shut up.
I hope. I'm sorry, because I'm for the listeners at home, who the other listener that maybe isn't mom.
Hi,
like,
Dad.
You know, I'm in film school right now. Yeah, for Dad, in case Dad didn't know. I'm in a master's program for film, and so like we do this thing where we watch films and then I have to talk about them in a very serious, like, academic way, and I make a point of like being quite articulate and thoughtful in my responses. And I feel like if any of my fucking classmates find this and hear me go off the rails about this goddamn movie, I will be like blacklisted.
Ruby, they will respect the hell out of you.
I associate the song so heavily with that compilation CD commercial that I could get those, all those CDs probably still for $19.95, yeah. Not including shipping and handling.
It's a good deal.
But yeah, no, I didn't realize how sweet it was in retrospect listening to it. And also, I mean, the other association is, of course, Community.
Yeah.
Where there's an episode where Troy and Abed start raising a lab rat and they name it Fievel, and then he escapes, and they harmonize quite beautifully to it, to the song.
It's a song that no matter what form it's in, it's gonna get me every time.
I know, I think they covered it, when did they cover it? Okay, so they released that on the soundtrack of the show like probably 10 years ago. I definitely downloaded it on iTunes when it did.
Yeah, no. Same. Currently,
we downloaded it on separate iTunes.
No, I think we've downloaded it on the same iTunes.
I was gonna say we paid for it twice
because we had the one family computer that had all of our stuff
in the computer room
that was always filled with paper.
Oh, that's 11 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Feel old yet? Wow.
I felt old this entire time. I felt old the minute the movie started and it opened with that pogrom.
Weird time to feel old.
Well, again, because I was sitting there being like, I'm sure this film doesn't start with the pogrom, and it did. It did.
That's the thing that I
think about before going to bed is the Time Life, Time Warner, whatever the name of that CD is, and the opening sequence of An American Tale.
Let's talk about Tiger.
Dom DeLuise as Tiger.
Now, Dom DeLuise, talked about it a little bit last week. He is one of my favorite actors, favorite voice actors. I feel like you can't have a Don Bluth movie without Dom DeLuise involved in it somehow.
Can't have Dom without Dom.
Exactly. Be the Dom to my Don, and vice versa, you know? And I love how they made Tiger the biggest cat in this gang that he's a part of.
He's a big boy.
He's a big, big boy. And Warren T. Rat, who is in fact a cat, spoiler, is so small. He is so small. He might as well be a little kitten.
Is that real for cats? That size? I mean, I've seen cats before in my life, but I feel the need to ask because you've already established yourself as an expert because of that whole calico debacle. But
that's just science, baby.
Is it possible that two cats could be that different in size and still be the same species of cat?
The same species?
Could they still be the same species of cat? I'm Sean Connery here for the gospel of Bluth
with Sean Connery. I mean, there are big cat breeds and there are smaller cat breeds, but like, this is like a very extreme difference.
So and what you're saying is if we were on CinemaSins right now, this would be a CinemaSin, the size differential between these two cats.
I don't know what that is, so I'm just going to say yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, noted. I'll make note of that.
Great.
Cool.
Yeah, Tiger, you know, I'm not a huge fan of his character. I'm going to say it. I don't like the song Duo very much.
No, it's bad.
It's bad. But I love Dom DeLuise, so it's fine.
Well, again, because of this, today I watched An American Tale, Five Oldies West, which, again, for the folks at home, is for the listening public, all of you out there, that is the sequel, and it's a lot more Tiger heavy. Like, he's the co-lead of that movie. And so this is another example where, like, I remembered Tiger as being more prominent in this film, but he really only comes in the third act. And it's like night. And that's it. He does like two good deeds. And it's enough to cement him as the co-lead of An American Tale, Five Will Goes West, but maybe on its own, not particularly memorable for this film.
No.
Which is not Dom DeLuise's fault. Is Dom short for Donald?
Yes, it is Dom.
It's not Donald DeLuise's fault.
Donald. Yeah. No, like, you know, he worked with what he was given, and I think he did a great job of that.
Yeah. The Wikipedia said that he got the role after he improvised that thing about, like, in the song Duo, when he's like, there's a lyric about someone getting their back scratched, and apparently Dom DeLuise's, like, star decision was to be like, we should stop the music and have them scratch each other's backs, and everyone was like, brilliant, the part is yours.
Well, improv,
you're in the film, you made it.
Improv back then was very simple, Ruby.
Yes, and?
Everyone could do it. Yeah, I feel like he's done a lot of improv with his roles in Don Bluth movies.
You would know more than I do. Tell me more about this.
Well, so far I've only rewatched this and Secret of Nim, and I feel like Secret of Nim, he did a lot of that. Because he was.
Does he do like that? What's the name of that improv game? Harold.
Ruby, it's not a game. It's a fucking style, and it's a fucking way of life. I took improv as a fourth grade after school activity, so I know what I'm talking about.
Okay, for the listeners at home.
Actually, it was fifth grade. Shit, it's fine.
Ooh, rough. And you know what the problem is? People at home are fact checking this.
I know. And
they're gonna
get my ass. I will say, having a cat that likes broccoli seems to be pandering.
Pandering to who? Pandering to who, Lily?
Ruby, it's pandering to the parents. Because, you know, children hate kid hate broccoli. Kid hate eat
okay,
broccoli.
No.
Kid hate eating broccoli.
But the thing is, Tiger is not, like, cool. Tiger, it doesn't stick, you know? I might have, like, I liked broccoli as a child. I might have willfully chosen not to eat it because I didn't want to be associated with, like, Tiger.
Ruby, maybe the children of the 80s were different. We are children of the 90s. We are children of the 90s.
I mean, if we're being completely honest, I'm a child of, I was born in 1969 in a lot of ways.
In a lot of ways. Yeah, no, you've got a point. He is, like, he is a loser, but he's a lovable loser, and Dom DeLuise is very good at playing lovable losers.
Oh, I love him. You know, I do love him.
He's Brooklyn's own.
But I think he has more to give in An American Tale, Five Will Goes West.
Well, again, it's the same with like Tony in the one where they find the underground society. It's just all of these like tiny side characters in the original get their like big shot.
Yeah. God, that was, and also in this, in that underground one, did Tony and Tanya date Tanya the sister, Fievel's sister, or was it still Bridget?
I think it was still Bridget, because that's the one where like Tanya's interning at a newspaper, right?
Maybe with like a Nellie Bly mouse.
Yeah.
And then, but there is romantic tension because doesn't Tony start flirting with like one of the underground mice girls?
Oh, I think so.
I mean, this is another episode right there. That's a weird, that's another one where I'm like, fever dream or real film?
Yeah. Well, a lot of the sequels, because they're not like real Don Bluth movies, they do feel like terrible waking nightmares, but like in a fun way. Like all of the Land Before Time sequels, all of them, I could have dreamt
them
up.
Who are you having on for that one?
I don't know yet. I have to think.
You should ask Barack Obama. Do you think he'd do it?
Barack Obama.
Barack and, Obama.
And Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Well, you got Jake. You might as well get Maggie.
I mean, you know, well, you can't have one without the other, I guess.
Barack Obama. I've never said his name that way. It's a lot of fun.
I'm getting Barack Obama.
I'm cracking myself up right now. I mean, this should tell you like the state of my emotional and mental well-being. I'm sitting here in my room going, Barack Obama, and I'm gonna cry.
Oh, there's your red face. You are about to cry.
I haven't laughed this hard since I put on a Zoom background that was Saturn eating his son, and I kept poking him in the mouth. I mean, for the, this is a visual, this is an audio medium, so I want to apologize to everyone. Right now, Lily and I are just sitting on opposite screens, crying and rubbing our faces while silently sucking in air.
I hate us.
I'm not going to say it again. I'm not going to say his name again. I'm not going to say it.
Barack Obama.
I'm going to say it one more time. Barack Obama.
Why is this so funny?
I don't know why, because it's like, it sounds like rock and roll, but it's Barack Obama.
Does it sound like rock and roll?
That's how I'm saying it.
Okay, no arguments there.
I really hope that no one on this island hears me doing that. They don't know me yet. They don't know me. They don't know about Saturn eating his son.
But they will soon. So the Great Mouse of Minsk, obviously it is a hearkening back to the beginning of the movie where Papa talks about the legend of the Mouse of Minsk, where he was like 100 feet tall and his tail was a mile long.
Well, this is interesting to me. It's not really that interesting.
Tell me why.
Minsk is in Belarus, but I guess it was Russia then.
So their village, Shostka.
Is it real?
Yeah, it's in Ukraine.
Wait, so that's different then.
But so, they say they're from Russia.
Well, so. They say they're from Russia. But his papa's grandfather is from Belarus. I mean, would Ukraine have been part of Russia then as well?
Maybe.
That's
part of the
my
Russian
question.
Empire.
Anyway.
So the Mouse of Minsk, the machine that these mice build, this intricate machine.
Can I ask you?
Terrified me. Yes.
If you were a cat, would you think that was a real mouse? would you look at that thing and be like, that's a real big mouse? Or would you think, that's a lot of, that's just a thing on a dolly?
Well, Ruby, I gotta say, cat dumb.
Cat dumb? Really? Do you think that, I mean, the whole mastermind, the criminal mastermind of the film is a cat.
Yes.
Warren T. Rat is explaining, I mean, he quotes Shakespeare, he plays music, he's a smart guy.
Ruby, look, real cats are dumb fucks. Have I met all cats?
I mean,
cats?
I agree with you there. I hate cats.
If I was a cat in the film, because it seems like the cats who are not in power are bozos.
Well, they're the muscle. They're the muscle.
Exactly. So if I was like a muscle cat in that gang, I would probably be terrified. I probably wouldn't understand why we were all running, and I would just run. But
yeah, but these are not like real cats. I mean, even in the context of this movie, you know, like they're cats who have like some semblance of these are cats these are sentient cats with consciousness and some amount of knowledge, and they couldn't look. These are cats that have passed the mirror stage in development, you know? Mm-hmm. They could look at a mirror and recognize that what they are seeing is a cat. So how could they not look at this giant, like, Trojan horse of a creature and be like, yeah, that's just a thing on wheels shooting fireworks that is operated, and the people operating it can't operate it forever. Like, strategically, how could they not? If they can recognize their own reflection, how could they not know that the giant mouse of Minsk was just, like, a push cart with a mask?
Well, I guess, like, think of it this way. It's 1885. You know, the world is changing, but you're a cat. And
Where are you going with this?
But I'm saying that,
how,
like,
are you going to justify this? I want to hear you walk.
Well, I'm saying that, like, you know, the world is changing. You're a cat. You don't understand how, like, certain things are made. Like, technological advances happen all the time. And, like, things that you could never have dreamed of are coming right off of the blueprint page.
Stop it. Just stop what you're doing right now. I lost track of whatever bullshit web you were spinning.
I lost track too. My brain is shutting down.
I could tell. But the same problem, there's the same problem in An American Tale, Five Goes West, which is that, like, the way that John Cleese's villain cat lures all these mice into going out west is he operates like a mouse puppet and convinces all the mice that it's a real puppet, but it's clearly on strings. And I'm just like, does everybody in these goddamn movies need to get their eyes checked? Like, what the fuck is going on here that you can't recognize something that is not living? Well, when all of you are portrayed as, like, sensitive, intelligent creatures.
Well, Warren T. Rat has this great line that I had to write down because I was just like, wow, that's good.
Warren T. Wow, did you come up with that yourself, Warren T. Rat? What did he say?
He said, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? And I just thought that was great.
I mean, I guess, like, that kind of explains what I was saying.
Yeah, kind of. Not quite, but we're getting
there.
Well,
what is the context there?
Well, because Fievel reveals to all of the mice that he's a cat, not a rat.
Yeah, he's saying that to the tenement mice. Okay, that makes sense.
Which also, interesting, that, like, yes, he's a cat pretending to be a rat, but also he's a rat in a mouse society. Like, he is, like, an FBI
rat.
He's always othered. No, I'm thinking, like, you know how Adriana was a rat. Big Pussy was a rat.
I don't think that's the connection here. I'm going to go ahead and say that those one of these things is not like the other.
Look, you're probably right.
I mean, I do think it's interesting that, I mean, to your point, if this, again, like, if I was dissecting this the way I would, like, in a real, the way I would a real film, which, by the way, I love that you had me on as someone who is, like, ostensibly, you know, a film theorist and an expert on film, and I just refuse to engage on that level. I refused. But if I was, then there is something to be said about, like, the intense othering that happens in this film in terms of, like, both with the cats, in the way that, like, the immigrant identity is construed here as, like, something that's both unified and then also, like, different. I mean, it's very much an epitome of, like, the melting pot ideology, because it's pretty much, like, as soon as everyone gets here, you're an immigrant, you're an immigrant. We've got Jewish Russian immigrants, Italian immigrants, Irish immigrants, and those are the only immigrants working together in this cross-cultural solidarity that also transcends class when you bring in, what's her name, Gussie, Madeline Kahn. It's this weird, like, yeah, this, the way that solidarity happens in this film is very optimistic, but I don't think particularly, in retrospect, not particularly accurate, and I think maybe a little bit too Pollyanna in its, the way that it evaluates the political situation, the political realities of immigrants and immigrant life in New York in 1885, if I may.
That was beautiful. Like, genuinely, that was, like, so, so amazing.
My God, I'm so good at talking out of my ass. Where did I get so good at this?
I think you bring up some incredible points, though, because it is, like, a very idealized, like, portrayal of immigration, especially in the 19th century, where it's, like, everyone is in this together, and you get here, and, like, you are, like, all having the same experience, and, like, Cats kind of acting as that, like, end-all, not that end-all be-all, but, like, kind of acting as that singular representation of, like, conflict and, like, the troubles that, like, immigrants.
Right, and so once you overcome that, then your troubles are over, so to speak. That's the only barrier to acceptance in society, which clearly is not the case. And I don't know. I think, you know, if I really wanted to get into it, I would probably admit that I'm quite disappointed in some of the politics of this film. And I think some of it is quite confused. But I get the intention of it. It's just that, yeah, maybe Don Bluth and Steven Spielberg didn't create the most cutting critique and analysis of the Russian Jewish immigrants' life in New York in this period, in this animated movie about mice.
I guess not. So I want to talk really quickly before anything else about the reunion at the very end. That still makes me cry.
Well, when Fievel's crying, I cry. So there's that moment where Fievel gets trapped with all the orphans.
Oh, those wretched orphans. No, yeah, they're in Brooklyn. I think that was, like,
I thought they were on the Lower East Side. But that's not the High Line, but, like, when he's with the orphans, it feels like that. Oh, wait. Yeah, do they live under the Brooklyn Bridge?
Yeah, they live in Brooklyn.
Oh, they do. They live in Williams. No, they don't. They live under the Brooklyn Bridge. Okay. Interesting. Oh, then, you know what? I'm going to mention something later. But anyway, yeah, so when he's reunited with his family, like, and he's crying, the orphans are like, nobody loves you. And you hear, like, this actual child actor crying. And also the animation gets really, like, bloopy. I don't know how to describe it.
It's a Don Bluth mouth. It is so emotive and, like, stretchy, and it can do anything.
It's kind of like the SpongeBob mouth when people frown in SpongeBob, but, like, a sadder, more emotive version of that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a more severe pout. Yeah, it's fucking heartbreaking. Just want to, like, hold him close.
But they find each other. They do. They find each other through the fog.
They do. They run to each Tiger. Other.
Yeah, when he starts screaming, Papa! Papa! Papa!
Papa! Bible!
Papa! Oh my God, beautiful. I mean, it does, the movie does get me in many ways. As much as I just tried to go in a little bit, as much as I just, like, softly went into the immigration politics of this film on an emotional level, It gets me. Besides that scene with the pigeons, who I hate.
Fuck those pigeons. I hate those pigeons. I hate those French pigeons. Also, hate that the movie implies that this pigeon has single-handedly built this fucking statue.
Yeah, like, it does. He does take credit for it.
But he takes credit for it, and you're like, haha, that's such like a silly thing to say. He's bird brained, people.
Oh.
But then you see him actually like hammer bolts into a part of the statue's inner like workings, and you're like, wait a minute. Did a bird?
Has this bird been building this? How did he commission this?
How old is this bird?
Especially at the very, very end of the film when all of our heroes get taken up by pigeons to come see the final version, the finalized Statue of Liberty. And you have that breathtaking and geographically inaccurate view of New York City and New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wow.
It really just gets you. So, just a few fun facts about the film. it was not a fun time for Don Bluth. He felt like he was losing freedom of control over the production process. Steven Spielberg had his company, Amblin, and it was coming out on Universal, so they expected to view the dailies and approve all of the major work on the film.
Oh my god, for an animated movie?
Yeah, and
that's like impossible. Why would you do that?
Well, exactly. Like, apparently various outside parties also requested changes here and there. And, you know, part of the reason Don Bluth left Disney was because, like, you know, he didn't agree with how they were making these films. And, like, when he first started Don Bluth Productions, it was run out of his garage with, like, his four other, like, animating buddies. So it was really, like, he had built this thing up himself. And suddenly he's, like, working with Steven Spielberg. He's working with Universal. And, like, scenes were being dropped to save time and money. And songwriters were, like, delivering scores much later. And they were... they weren't, like, storyboarding the way that he wanted to. It was, like, a mess, kind of. It was also plagued by union difficulties.
Oh no! Here I come in as the union typist
with your big pointy glasses.
Yeah, being like, let me get that down. I'm gonna send this to Big Jerry.
Big Jerry. So Bluth had agreed to accept $6.5 million to get it produced. And he knew that would be very hard because, you know, Disney, like, the average seemed to be about 10 or 11 million, although Disney was spending about 12 million per film. But he felt that it was worth it to sacrifice. It was worth the sacrifice to work with Spielberg on a major project.
Oh no. Did he violate animation union contracts?
Well, with the agreement of his employees, salaries were frozen for a year and a half.
Scab.
Canceled. Unlike the former Bluth Studios, the new Sullivan Bluth Studios were non-union. And when many workers attempted to withdraw from the union, it sparked a battle between Bluth and the union that continued through most of production. It was
bad.
Mostly...
I'm outside with a giant warranty blow-up rat who's dressed now like warranty rat.
Oh!
I'm that person. I rented that rat that they always put outside during strikes. I'm doing that. I can't believe you, Donald Bluth.
Don Bluth says that this struggle between him and the union compelled him to relocate to Ireland, which he felt offered more supportive atmosphere.
That's a scab and a half right there. Leaving the country because you don't want to deal with the union? No! I'm so disappointed right now.
I know.
My blood is boiling. Boiling.
Folks, her blood is boiling. So that's a fun fact. Do you have any other thoughts about this film? Like, you know, what would you say, watching it now as a 24-year-old living in London?
London.
Or as the Romans called it, Londinium. What?
Yeah.
I'm cultured.
The experience of rewatching it was being like, this film isn't, you know, thinking that the film like hinted at or coded at certain historical moments or like nodded to them, but not that it was going to be so explicit about it. And I, you know, there is a part of me that does actually appreciate that and does appreciate the fact that, again, the Moskowitz family is actually explicitly Jewish, because you don't really see that. In animated films or in children's movies, like characters that are not just coded as being, you know, not like, you know, the norm is always like a WASP family. So anytime someone is not that and it's explicit about that, I think it actually is quite a moving little powerful thing. And some of the nods that do happen in the film that you can tell are from someone's real experience, like that scene when Fievel is looking into the school window, but he's not a part of that. I think stuff like that was actually quite powerful.
That was you know, a heartbreaking bit of animation.
Yeah,
too.
And that's a true story from Steven Spielberg's grandfather's experience coming to America. And I think you can feel that in the film. But also, like, you know, remembering that it's a kids' movie, so, you know, me wanting this, like, this hard-hitting examination of the realities of that, like, you know, I could just go off and read Mouse and art speak once Mouse and be depressed, but I'm not going to do that.
I mean, art has repeatedly accused Steven Spielberg of plagiarism because of
representations of Jewish people as mice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know that, which...
Oh, you know that already?
That's its
own
thing.
I guess. Oh, I'm sorry. No. I didn't realize you knew that.
No. My point being that, like, I think... Given what this movie is, which is a movie for people who are not 24, it is quite really sweet. And I think it does do a lot of like really cool things. And like the things that I'm disappointed by as an adult, as a political adult, I think as a child, I would actually be still quite moved by and taken by. And, you know, that they did. I know for a fact that they meant a lot more to me when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So I don't want to diminish that at all. Yeah.
No, for sure. I think, I think I feel the same way about a lot of what you mentioned. Like, I think my biggest complaints about the film are just like purely coming from a cynical place where it's like, that song is dumb, or like, why cat like broccoli? You know, like little things.
Those are the things that bother you.
Look, among other things, those were just the first two that came to mind.
Yeah.
I could go into how I don't think that, female characters are represented very well.
Wait a second, so Bridget isn't a strong female character. Oh my god,
well,
no!
No, listen, I don't like the way that she's animated. I think... With Don Bluth movies, there is a very severe way of like how they animate like the genders.
Yeah, gendered mice. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where it's like any like female character is gonna either be wearing like a big bow, or they're gonna have like they're not gonna say anything and they're just gonna go and they're like they're gonna have big boobs. I don't. It's
tiny waist.
Yeah,
dumb
tiny
waist. Is that what you said earlier? Is that what you described her as having?
I did say Gussie had a dump truck ass.
So waist snatched, dump truck ass. Oh gosh.
Oh, I hate myself. Whatever. There's a lot to complain about. It's not a perfect movie.
No, but I think, oh my God, I was so negative on this film and this podcast that I don't think I really got across the fact that I do love it.
Oh, yeah.
That it does have a special place in my heart. I'm just giving it shit because I know the only person, you know, like the three people listening to this, you know, they don't.
Okay, what if more than three people listen to this podcast? You're going to feel like a real dope.
I will, because I said a lot of dumb things.
Yeah, imagine how I feel.
You know, I respect your bravery for doing this. As you know, I like to be neither seen nor heard.
Do you even exist?
Arguable. Mm. Arguable.
This is good to know.
Debatable.
Yeah, this is good to know.
You're going to post this podcast up here, and somehow, miraculously, like, all my audio will not, it'll just be, like, blank.
And I'll just be laughing to myself.
Yeah, I'll be like, wait a second. She wasn't, none of that was recorded, and yet I hit record. Did that really exist at all? Arguable.
Yeah, I'm worried too. Ruby, do you have anything you want to plug?
Absolutely not. I have nothing to plug. I got nothing to say about nothing. Don't ask me anything. Don't try to find me on social media. Don't try to Google me. If you know, to those of you listening at home, if we meet, we meet. That's life. But, you know, yeah, no.
A perfect response. Well, I give this feature 10 out of 10. And with that, before I descend any further into pure delirium, thank you for listening to the Gospel Bluth.
No.
Next week we'll be talking about Land Before Time. My guests, I don't know yet.
Barack Obama and Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Thanks for tuning in. Like, subscribe, all that bullshit. And
this episode has been brought to you by Steve, my neighbor.
The fuck? Thank you. And
I gotta re-record an outro. I'm sorry. Record it while I'm gone.
And we'll see you somewhere out there.